funny.
Well, should we assume that whoever else is coming is going to turn up?
When they turn up, if they turn up?
Or not.
Yeah.
At some point, I'm pretty sure they will, but it's, I suppose it's a little bit tricky to find if you don't know this area, isn't it?
But your directions were very good. On the
perfect, yeah.
They were perfect, it's just that I forgot to bring them with me, so I had no clue.
Yeah, that's the why.
Debbie, my assistant, also forgot, so two of us were completely blind. I did remember which station to get off at, so that was good enough.
Do you think you put a sign on the door just saying truth at the moment? Because some people, you didn't notice the bit that said cranial
sacral. It was so funny because I read from the top, first, second, third, and I missed the fourth, which was the cranial sacral.
Yeah. I think I could easily have walked past it. It might be.
Why didn't you write truth at the moment on here and just stick it on the door?
Yeah, I just put my name on it or something.
What do you want, the name?
Yeah,
the name would be
better. Ian Watson Seminar.
Should I do that?
Yeah, if you wouldn't mind, Fergus, thank you.
It's a sealed tape, isn't it?
I don't know if you can find it.
There are supply cupboards around the back that seems to have absolutely everything in the world.
Everything in the world.
Press one.
Now, I'm just looking at who's here and figuring out who wasn't in the group last year. I think it's just, for the current company, it's just you, Susie, but
yeah.
there's another... At least another one who's supposed to be coming, who's also one. That's about as big as the door, isn't it?
Yeah. They miss that.
So, I'm wondering, what was I wondering? Yeah, you probably saw this course advertised, did you? I would think.
I did, yeah.
In my newsletters and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wondered whether you followed any of the kind of clues or breadcrumbs that were mm-hmm. around it
and
then, to get a sense of what it was
not,
about.
Probably not, Ian, actually. I haven't done that, but I just, because I know you and because of stuff that I've been doing, you know, etc., I kind of have an idea.
Cool. That's
and
fine.
If it's wrong, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Yes,
we've all
exactly
got our own
so
idea.
I've just come to sort of be.
That's perfect,
basically.
Yeah.
I'm not
great.
Expecting anything.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. That's great. Because obviously the bulk of us in this kind of went through a course together.
Yeah.
There's a few joining, as I say, who didn't. But it's the kind of I was going to say material, but that's not the right word, is it? It's the kind of subject, shall we say, that
experience.
It doesn't seem to matter whether you've heard it for the first time or the umpteenth time,
yeah,
in that sense.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's what I got the sense of, and, you know, I'm just fitting, I'm just not worried. Yeah.
It's not content-based, and so it's not like, you know, you start with the first bit and then you work your way through the syllabus. There was no syllabus as such. It's an exploration of something very simple. Was it not? Was it not? And I mean, what's fun for me is to see you folks again and to sort of, so we can do a bit of checking in and just get a sense of what the hell you've been doing with it since we last met, which will be interesting in itself. And also opportunity to share some of the things that I've been learning, because as many of you will know, I've simultaneously to starting the second training, I've been attending what's been billed as a trainer's training. So I'm actually learning how to train people now. Now that you guys are finished, I'm supposedly learning how to do it properly, and of course I have that experience. I'm not really learning anything different or anything new. It's
confirmation,
really
confirmation, maybe.
Half and what?
Probably just confirmation.
Well, there's a lot of confirmation, but there's also, I think there's a value in seeing how other people do it, which I hadn't really been exposed to before. And that, I am finding that useful, just recognizing that there's each person that works with this same very tiny piece of information works with it in a unique way. And even though I'm not into copying anybody, I just find it really fascinating and interesting to learn how other people have been teaching it and presenting it in a completely different way to what I would have thought of. So that's been nice. And it's also been good because, for me, to be part of a group as a student again has been fantastic. So the group that I'm in, it's a group of, there's 24 of us, and we meet bi-monthly, 3 days at a time. And we're just beyond the halfway mark of that group now. And it's already, I feel like I've known those people forever. You know that?
Are you doing it now
too?
No. No, there's no one else in this group in there. I just kind of slipped in, to be honest. It was supposed to be for people who'd already done a bunch of stuff with these trainers that my friend Jamie was bringing over from the US. I hadn't done any of it, but at the last minute he said, there's a place left, you want to join? I was like, okay. That's clearly for me, you know. And then I noticed that, like, he sent me the thing with all the criteria, which said, you know, you must have attended this and this. And I said, well, you know, by the way, Jamie, I haven't attended anything. He says, I know. I think you'll be fine, you know. And he obviously knows me well enough. And, of course, it was fine. So I was in the same boat as you are, essentially,
coming
into this.
I was just thinking that. Yeah.
It was exactly the same feeling.
Yeah.
And my initial sense was like, oh, well, you know, everybody here obviously has heard a lot of stuff that I haven't. And maybe that'll make a difference. Maybe it won't. It didn't.
Yeah,
it didn't seem to.
I don't really feel at all.
Yeah. And the two trainers that I've been studying with is Mark Howard and Kathy Casey. Hi, Nina.
Hi.
Hi, Martina.
Hi.
Welcome.
Just off the bus.
Just off the bus. Well done for getting here.
Oh.
Come enjoy. We're just getting going, so you haven't really missed anything. So yeah, I've been participating in that group. As I say, the two trainers, Mark Howard and Kathy Casey, they were among the very first sort of small group of people who were initially exposed to Sydney Banks's own teaching in the 1970s, I guess it was. And Mark Howard was a psychologist, Kathy Casey was a social worker. So they both went, you know, with different backgrounds. What they had in common was that they'd both seen the limitations of what they'd already learned. You know, they'd already done their trainings, qualified, and then in the course of trying to practice what they'd learned, they realised it kind of didn't work a lot of the time. Mark found that from a psychology point of view. He was frustrated with the fact that a lot of people just couldn't help. And Kathy also. Kathy told a funny story which was just on my mind as I was coming in. Where she was working as a social worker in a setting where they were working with families with a lot of dysfunction. So like the teenagers were going off the rails, or there was drug problems, or, you know, this kind of thing. So it was kind of family therapy where they'd get the parents in, or sometimes it would be a single parent and the kids, and try and get them to function better as a family. And she was working in this setting where it was an office setup where the walls were very thin. So she had a colleague who was working right next door, doing essentially the same work. And she said that her sessions were like really heavy, and, you know, it was awful. And everybody's telling about all these disasters that had happened, and, you know, this son's been locked up and this other one's on drugs again, and, you know, and she said it was used to come out with a headache and it was terrible. And then next door, what was really annoying her was all day long, there was just laughter coming from this office next door. It's like people rolling about laughing. They'd all come out with big smiles on their face, like they'd had the best time. And eventually she got fuming about this, and she went to the director of the centre. She's like, how come you're sending me all the bloody heaviest cases and you're sending her all the easy ones? You know? And he just looked at her and he said, they're randomly allocated, Kathy. There's no difference between the ones that are coming to you. I promise you, there's no difference. And she was like, you know, she didn't believe it for a while. And eventually she thought, well, it must be. So she asked the colleague, you know, have you got any special treatment? I don't think so. She said, well, what are you doing different? And that's what opened her eyes to the fact that there was something going on here. So it turned out the colleague that she'd ended up working next door to had been exposed to three principles, had continued to work as a social worker in the same setting, but obviously from a different point of view, she would say, and it just transformed her work and was transforming the lives of the people that she was working with. So when she saw that, it was like, whatever it is, I want some of that, you know. So she just basically followed her around wherever she went. And she said it took her quite a while to get the gist of it, but she's a fabulous teacher, and she's become quite well known now as pioneer for bringing it into the prison system in the US and the correctional units for young offenders and stuff. She's done amazing work with that and has some fantastic stories to tell. And she also worked in a unit for resident schizophrenics as well. So it's people who are actually locked up, you know, in a secure unit, all diagnosed with schizophrenia, mostly on heavy medication, mostly with a kind of diagnosis that would suggest they're never going to get out, you know. And she worked in that for, I think it was a period of a couple of years. Again, fabulous stories to tell about healings that are not supposed to be possible, you know, in that sort of a setting. So that's also been good for me, just to, you know, when people who've specialised in a certain area and they've been given access to these kind of situations, which it's not the sort of situation that I've ever worked in, what it does give you is a sense of what's possible with this. And it still blows my mind when I hear some of this stuff. It's kind of, it's ridiculous that this is not widely known about. You know, that's the response that everybody has, is like, how on earth is this, why is this still a secret? It's kind of crazy that this is not widely known. And yet, we know the answer to that. Those of you who have been studying it for a year or two, as I have, why is it still a secret?
Because if we all found this within ourselves, we all had lived in an environment where we found this within ourselves easily, we'd all feel we'd all be empowered and we'd all live in an amazing world. And
yeah.
Unfortunately, there are other energies that would want that.
Okay, that's
possibly.
That's one take on it. What else would you say, Martina?
I think it's because it's too simple.
I think that's a big part of it. That's a big part of it.
That it comes through an insight.
Yes.
You can't give anybody insight.
You can't give it to somebody. That's another big part of why it remains a secret, is because it doesn't fit the category of something that's teachable in a normal way, because there's nothing to it. There's nothing to teach. There's no body of information. There's, as I said, there's no curriculum you can put people through. And this makes it very elusive, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's and it also, it means that it tends to get undervalued very easily.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very easy for someone to look at this and say, like, well, okay, yeah, I get that. Is that it?
Yeah.
You know, what else have you got? But you're seriously going to talk about that for 9 months, you know? Because, I mean, really, the conversation's over in the first 2 minutes. And that is that's the main thing, I think, that you could say that this understanding, what we call it as an understanding, that's what it's up against in terms of wider acceptance. It's up against the fact it's so damn simple, there's so little to it, and it doesn't match our preconceived ideas of something as a subject to be learned, if you like. As Nina says, it's based on the assumption that each of us is capable of having insight, having realization, and that, in fact, that's the only thing that ever changes anybody, at least in a sustainable way. What really changes people's behaviour in a sustainable way is when they see something for themselves that they hadn't seen before. So the problem being, we can't force anybody to have an insight. We can't make it happen, even for ourselves. We can't make it happen. And yet what we can do is recognise it when it does, and we can point people towards the fact that it happens. And so that they're a little bit alert to that, so that when they do get insight, and I'm not talking about massive revelations, an insight can be a minor thing that still has a big impact on your life. But what we can do is become aware, alert to the fact that insight is way more valuable than we generally credit it as being. So what we've come to do is we value information, but we don't value insight. We've got it topsy-turvy.
Mm-hmm. But that comes from the way we're brought up in the classic school system. Of,
yeah,
you know,
it's
we're
been
not
drilled
taught
into
that
us.
We know everything that we need to know at the beginning. As I remember the perspectives of Lakeland, that's what I loved, was that it's just an unravelling. You know everything you need to know. We're not taught that. We're taught that actually you need to listen and you need to do this in order to be able to
have
that.
It's got to be put into you.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. So this, to me, I mean, the true meaning of the word education is that, isn't it? It's to draw out. So this is actually, it fits the bill perfectly in terms of, this is a true education. Because the only way you're ever going to get it is if it's uncovered within you, if it's drawn out, if you like. No one can put it in you from the outside. And as a facilitator, or someone who's trying to share this in any kind of capacity, that is both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing because, well, thank God I don't have to remember it all, you know, and I don't, because there isn't that much to remember, and I'm not responsible for anybody else getting it because I can't. That's the blessing part. The curse part is, well, how the hell do we create the circumstances that are conducive to insight happening? Because although there are some, let's say, general guidelines that seem helpful, like a lot of facilitators will say, don't try and learn this as a normal subject, don't try and remember it, don't pay too much attention to the words and the content. They'll say things like, listen for the feeling. You know, it comes with it, it's conveyed via a feeling rather than information. So you kind of, you hear that, and you say, well, yeah, okay, right, yeah, well, what feeling exactly? Even that's not necessarily helpful, even though someone points it out to you. So it's a challenge, but for me, it had an immediate resonance. I just want to backtrack a little bit, because I'm not sure if I ever told this to all of you as a group, but prior to my coming across this, I know that all of you will know I did a lot of other things, chiefly the homeopathy for years. And I did...
I think it's Yama.
Okay, feel free to take it,
yeah,
so you can help her. Help to track her down. It's not Yana?
No.
Okay. Somebody else. So, having come through the homeopathy, it led me into what I came to call emotional release work. I came through the Brandon Bay's journey training, which I know some of you love, like Nina. And Martina. We love Brandon.
Yes,
yeah.
We love Bristol.
And so I did the whole training in that, and then I, as is my nature, I kind of blended that with other things that I'd learned along the way, and I learned some family constellation work. I did a lot of dream analysis for a while, got into the Jungian stuff, symbolism, and all this. And what started to dawn on me, first of all, was I saw that a lot of suffering is caused by the simple fact that people are holding on to feelings that are uncomfortable. You know, they're spending a lot of their daily hours just in discomfort, and consequently they're not able to access the good feelings. You know, I just started to see that that's a common fact for a lot of people, whether or not that's what they're aware of or that's what they consulted for. I just started to see that's the common feature amongst humankind, is that people are just trying to feel better than the way they feel. Everybody just wants to feel good, basically. And almost everything that we're doing in the outside world, whether it be seeking a practitioner, going on a homeopathy training, buying a lottery ticket, moving job, changing partner, changing house, everything that we're doing is connected to the idea that in so doing, we're going to get a better feeling state. I started to see that more and more clearly. It's the number one driver for all of our behaviour. Is that we just want to feel good. We want to feel better than what we're feeling. And I started asking people, my role became a bit of a coaching role, really, with a lot of my one-to-one clients. I would ask people, you know, what is it that you're really after? You know, what do you want? And most people would start off with a list of tangible things. And then we go through that pretty quickly and say, well, okay, let's suppose, you know, I've got the magic wand here. You've got all of that today already. Just imagine, it's already arrived. You've got all the money you could need. You've got the partner that fits the bill for you. You've got the career that's, you know, you feel that you haven't had, or whatever it is. I said, now what's changed for you? And you see, you know, if the person went into that, if they kind of went into it in their imagination, I would see that their shoulders would drop, their body would relax. Oh, well, you know, that's great. I don't have to worry about money anymore. And yeah, I've got a loving partner. That's cool. And I've got fulfillment in my work instead of doing a boring job. Yeah, that's nice. So I'd listen to what they were saying. I said, so what you really wanted was, you wanted to be free from anxiety. You know, you said you wanted money, but what you really wanted was to not have to worry. I said, yeah. And when you talked about having a partner, what you really want is to feel the love that you weren't feeling in the absence of the partner. I said, yeah. And on it went. And when you talked about the career, what you really wanted was that sense of fulfillment that you think the career will give you, which you're not currently getting in the job. So I would start teasing it apart like this and showing the person that anything on the outside that we say is important to us It's connected to something on the inside which is more important. And if it doesn't satisfy that for us, we're going to keep looking. We're going to play a substitution game where we basically, you know, it's revolving doors, isn't it? One thing comes in to our life and that's it. And it's it for how long, you know, a few weeks or a month if you're lucky. And then without noticing that we've done it, we go looking again because it didn't really satisfy. Some people notice, but most people don't even notice that they've just substituted one thing for another. Oh, yeah, well, that was fine, but now I need this. You know, and it's endless. So I worked with, I don't know how many... Hi, Anne. Come join us. I worked with, I mean, I don't know how many hundreds of individuals over the time, and it got to the point where I just knew for certain that nobody really wanted what they said they wanted. They didn't even have to tell me. They didn't have to give me the list. I just, you don't really want that, you know. Let's just cut to the chase here. What you really want is to feel good, right? You want some good feelings. And with a little bit more observation, I started to see that those feelings were pretty much the same for everybody across the board. And there's not that many. Everybody wanted a sense of fulfillment. Everybody wanted to feel love. Everybody wanted to be at peace within themselves. Everybody wanted to feel free. So, you know, if anybody had the sense that they were somehow constricted or restricted, they wanted the feeling of freedom that they imagined would come from changing something in their life. Everybody wanted to feel safe and secure. These were just the common basic feelings that everybody wants to feel. There's maybe, I don't know, maximum of 8 or 9 things. Everything else was just subsets, you know, just variations on those few basic themes. So I thought, well, okay, my work was getting easier by this point, you know. It used to be that I had to help people achieve lots of different goals. And then it got simpler because I started to see, no, there's just a few basic goals. Everybody's really looking for the same few things. They just don't know it. So that really was kind of reinforcing that I was onto something with the emotional release work. I thought, well, this is really what makes a difference in people's lives is when they feel good. When people's feeling level goes up, what I noticed was they get less concerned with all that external stuff. So I started to make that connection too. So when someone, and I noticed it in my own life, you know, if I was in a state of anxiety and insecurity, that's the time when I'd get really busy thinking that, you know, I needed to work more and, you know, organize some seminars and stuff like this. And I noticed that paradoxically, when I felt relaxed about it, even if I didn't have any money or any work lined up, I didn't seem to care. You know, it kind of plugged me into the other good feelings of trust. And, you know, I would tend to trust that something's going to turn up, even though I don't know what it is yet. So I got curious about that. I thought, well, that's interesting, because it seems that we've got it kind of wired the wrong way around. You know, we get busy at the time when it's least helpful to get busy. Or we distract ourselves with external things at the time when it's least helpful. What's most helpful is to basically not do anything at that stage or do whatever you feel you need to do to connect yourself with that good feeling again, which seems to have gone missing. That was how I experienced it. We just go missing periodically. And then I'd get lost trying to look for it. And then I'd remember, Ian, it's not out there. And then I'd, you know, basically reconnect myself to it. Ah, yeah, it's in here. And then from that place of okayness, life would get easy again. Even if there wasn't much in the way of material stuff happening right there and then, I just knew it would. And sure enough, as soon as I started looking in that direction, things would open up really quickly. And I call that being in the flow of life. And I think all of you have experience being in the flow and not being in the flow, yeah? It's just part of the deal of being human. So I was kind of getting more and more curious about this. It was like, well, how does that work, this being in the flow business, you know? How come it's a bit sort of, now you see it, now you don't? How can we lose that when we know that that's what works? You know, we've had that experience that when you just relax into it and you don't try and force anything to happen that's not ready to happen, and you don't busy yourself with external things, but if you just relax into that, reconnecting with that, whatever we call it, that core within oneself that is, it always has that reassuring okayness to it.
It's
even
a wholeness for me. It's a wholeness.
Wholeness, yeah. I mean, we can use different words to say it, but you know what I'm talking about. How come that we forget that so readily? That was puzzling to me. Because I'd had long periods in my life where I'd just been living in the flow for months on end. And it was beautiful, you know, like it was effortless. I just had to think it and it would show up, you know. And sometimes even before I'd thought it, it would show up. the door would open, I'd bump into the right person, and then someone would just ask me, are you interested in this? And I was like, that's the very thing I was interested in, I was looking for. How did they know? And it was a complete ease to life. And I think when you've had a taste for that, you can't forget that you've had a taste for that. You know, it's like you've seen it. You've seen the gold, and then it gets buried again. You know, where the hell did it go? So I was kind of puzzled at the sort of the hidden mechanics, shall we say, of that. What that puzzlement, that curiosity, led me to study things like The Secret, you know, the law of attraction. Because it seemed that that was related. You know, this whole idea that our inner state is attractive. That's what brings things into our life, and it's that what also repels things from our life. So I studied that periodically. And that was interesting to me because I know a lot of people that got into that, and most of them are really good at manifesting parking spaces. And, you know, and what was interesting to me was that they would boast about this, that they could always manifest a wonderful parking space, and they were driving a wreck, you know, which was always breaking down. And I thought, well, you might want to start with manifesting a decent car, you know. That would be more impressive. I was not impressed by this manifesting parking space nonsense, you know. Uh-huh. It's like, that's no big deal for me. And I couldn't get why a lot of people didn't see that inconsistency, you know. They thought that it was cool to be able to manifest relatively trivial things. And yet it was perfectly okay that the more important things, that even they would say were more important, hadn't shown up yet, you mm-hmm. know. So people would have all kinds of reasons and excuses why that, you know, it's because of my unconscious thinking that I haven't quite cleared out.
You hear that a lot, don't you?
Right, well, you have to come up with some.
Yeah, this whole thing with The Secret and attraction, yes, of course, you know. But then there are people that you see and they're not really consciously doing it. So you think, well, you know, there's something not right there.
It doesn't quite add up, does it?
It doesn't add up.
Every now and again it looks like it does.
Yes. And then it doesn't.
And then there's all these anomalies. There's all these exceptions. Yeah. I know for a fact that stuff showed up in my life. I never ordered that.
Oh.
You know, I really didn't. I'm sorry. I didn't. And there was a lot of stuff I definitely ordered that didn't arrive, you know.
Yeah.
And I did my damnedest to get my own
yeah.
stuff out of the way.
Absolutely.
It didn't show up. I thought, well, there's something else to this.
Yeah.
And the other thing that, again, was an inconsistency for me was I already knew too much about the fact that it's not really the stuff that we say we want. That's not really what we want.
Mm-hmm.
I already knew that. So it became a kind of stupid game for me. I was like, why am I even bothering? Because I know it's not the car. It's a good feeling that I think I'm going to have if I had the car.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I had to let that go at some point. I'm getting a little chilly. Anybody else?
Mm-hmm.
Can we
just knock
it on for a minute?
Yeah.
Maybe one of the ones that's a bit away. Oh, the quieter one. Yeah, that would be good. Thanks, Leslie. Because the other one was blasting a bit with the fan.
Do you want this one on?
Maybe, just till it warms up a bit. It's a big space, so it loses the heat quickly, doesn't it?
That's what
it is. We'll find our level.
I have a
little. I think it's the difference between the car parking space is an opportunity, but the car is a reality.
No.
No.
I don't think there's any difference whatsoever.
Also, what I notice is there's a lot of blame attached to all that stuff.
Of course, there has to be.
It's like, well, what aren't you doing?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You created that cancer.
Yeah,
what's wrong with you?
This. Yeah, exactly.
And it's easy to get guilt trips and stuff like that associated with it. And that, again, is one of the reasons why it didn't quite fit for me.
Absolutely.
Even though I know that there was a bit of truth in it.
Yes.
You know, there was enough
yes.
truth in it for it to be curious about,
yeah.
but not enough to satisfy
yeah.
somewhere. So I kept scratching the surface. What I did start to see through the emotional release work was that there was a relationship between feeling states and beliefs. And it was that way around that I learned that. I discovered through my consultation work that if you want to find out what emotions someone's sitting on, just prod one of their core beliefs. You'll see those feelings rise to the surface pretty quickly. everybody gets hostile or defensive or even aggressive when you challenge one of their core beliefs. And that was something I kind of stumbled on by accident, and then I got curious about that. Well, that's interesting. It's interesting that everybody will fight to defend their core beliefs, even if the beliefs are not particularly life enhancing. Yeah, yeah. That was interesting to me, that we could believe things which were actually causing us a lot of suffering,
yeah,
but we would refuse to negotiate that belief. We'd refuse to
defend
let it go.
Them to the death.
We defend it to the death. I thought, how strange that is. How strange we are. But what I saw was that the beliefs, really, which was really the thought patterns that a person was repeatedly holding, or let's say it looked like continuously holding for a long time, that seemed to be what kept the feelings in place and the behaviours in place and a lot of the other stuff that the person would say, I want to change these things in my life. And yet there seemed to be some beliefs about the fact that it wasn't possible for them, or I don't deserve it, or people like me can't do that. And I started to see that there is some truth in that. If you hold a belief which is counter to your intention, whatever you say you want, it's not going to happen. So I thought, So that led me into the idea of belief change must be where it's at. I don't give up, okay? Each time I thought I was getting closer to cracking something here. And so I was looking around at the whole belief change field. And I almost got into NLP with that, because they'd done work in that area, but it didn't appeal to me for some reason, so I left it. And I looked at people like Dick Olney, who's an American guy, not very well known, did fabulous work. He was using light trance hypnosis to change beliefs, but he produced some very interesting work around that. Also the eidetic imagery. I don't know if any of you remember me teaching that. Yeah? This was a few years ago. There's certain images which can be evoked inside of us, and they help to change those thought patterns that we hold on to. I explored that for a while. On it went. And eventually I came across Ron Kurtz and his Hakomi work. And this to me was like, this was the closest of anyone that I'd found as a kind of living example of someone who was working in a way that I'd been aspiring to work. You know, I saw somebody who was, he was incorporating all of the other things that I'd been interested in into this technique. It wasn't really a technique, it was a body of things that he'd put together, and he just called it Hakomi so that no one would know what it was, you know. Because he'd borrowed from Gestalt, he'd borrowed from Jungian, he'd borrowed from here and transpersonal psychology, and mostly from his own experience. And he was a lovely guy, and I saw that there was this kind of elegance to the way that he worked. And it was what I loved about Ron's work was it was predicated on the fact that healing only happens when there's loving presence. That was his starting point. So technique and everything else was secondary to that in his eyes. And I loved that. I thought that just was like yes to me, you know. If there isn't the loving presence and the acceptance of who the person is and where they are in their life, then you've got no permission to even start messing with their beliefs or anything else. So, and that's what he attempted to actually train people in, was how to cultivate loving presence. And I really admired him for that, because that's not an easy thing. It's about as difficult as training people in this. You know? It's like, how do you train people to have loving presence with anybody that might come through their door? You know, it's not easy. So anyway, he was finding ways to do that. And then he developed creative ways to... he used these things called probes. So a probe would be a statement or a question that was specifically designed to elicit the unconscious belief. So it's very similar to what I'd stumbled on, you know, by poking the core belief. And he made the observation that you'd know when you'd elicited the belief because the person would get emotional. I thought, bingo, me too. You know, that's exactly what I discovered. But he had a better developed framework around that than I had, because he'd been working in that field for longer than I had. So I thought, Ron Kurtz is my man. I'm going to study everything he's got. And I went and did a bit of training with him in Ireland. And he got curious about my background at some point, and I gave him a copy of The Tao of Homeopathy. No, he didn't know much about homeopathy. He loved it. He just understood it completely. You know, he absolutely understood that it was all about where you're coming from, not about what you're doing. And that's what that book is pointing to. He ordered 12 copies to give to his friends for Christmas. which was so funny, because he gave one to Murray Feldman. I don't know if any of you know Murray.
Yeah.
Because Murray at this time had started studying Hakomi. And Murray was one of my homeopathy teachers, like,
yes.
25 years ago.
Oh,
and he gave it, and he's like really excited, you know, like a kid giving a, you know, present to his mum or something. And he said, Murray, you know, I found it. I met this guy in England. It's a great book, you know, you probably haven't heard of it. The Doubt, and Ian, and Murray's like, yeah, yeah, I know Ian, yeah. Completely unimpressed, you know. So it was very sweet. So Ron and I had this good connection, and he got quite excited by the possibilities of other people taking his work much farther than he personally could take it. You know, he was aware of the fact that he was in his 70s, his appetite for global travel was diminishing, and his ability to do so was diminishing. So he started emailing myself and a few other people in Europe, different parts of the world, saying, I'd like to basically put a body of material together with your help, and we'll turn it into a training which you guys can be the facilitators of, you know, pointing to me and other. I was like, geez, I don't know shit, you know. But somehow he clocked that it was, it's not about how long you've been studying it, it's about the level to which you see it, to, you know, experience. And he somehow, he understood that we had a resonance, we had a, there was things that I could grasp very quickly that he'd probably struggle to teach other people. So he counted me into this cliquey group, you know. So I was thinking, oh, this is cool. Suddenly I've got a club that I've managed to become a member of, you know. I don't know how, blagged my way in. And it felt like a good fit for me. So I was very excited about this. Ron started shipping all this video material, and it was great stuff that he'd been putting together. And he sent out this long email saying how excited he was and how the whole program was going to kick off in a few months' time, and that was the day before he died.
Wow.
The next day, he went for a haircut at the barber shop and dropped dead in the barber shop.
Oh my God.
And I was so stunned. I was like, you know, I spent months getting really excited and really into it, and it's like, this is great, and it's exactly what I've been looking for. I just felt like I was on track, you know?
Mm.
And then he was like, bye-bye. And the weird thing was that he'd left me this kind of legacy of stuff, not just me, but he'd sent it to a body of, like, chosen few people and said, basically, you know, take it out. This is the work as far as I've taken it, but, you know, do your best to take it out. So I kind of had this really peculiar feeling of almost like responsibility,
yeah,
to him, you know, to his work, which lasted about 5 minutes. And and then I had to just sit in the kind of unknown of it for a while. It was about 3 months where I just sat with it, and I had no clue where to go from there. Because on the one hand, it was great, and it really was close to where I was at. And on the other hand, I started to see that it was very personal to him. You know, what I'd got from it was very personal to him. And for reasons that I can't even describe, I just lost interest in studying it with anybody else, or in being part of this, you know, this group of facilitators who were going to take it out into the world. I just couldn't go there. I couldn't do it. And I was like, damn, you know? It's like I'd found it, and then it had gone, slipped through my fingers. So there was this 3-month waiting period. It's like, okay, I suppose you think that's funny, you know? And I could see Ron kind of laughing from the other side, you know? It was to me, it was a classic Ron Kurtz move, because
yeah,
he was a Taoist. I mean, he really understood the Tao. I think that's why he got the Tao of homeopathy, just like that. He understood that it was, there's this kind of flow to life, there's this undercurrent to life, and that's what that intelligence is what's really in charge. We just think we are. Momentarily, we delude ourselves that we're running the shop, and then the rest of the time we realize that that's not true. So I know that he was really living out of that. That deeper, and I call this a deeper intelligence, with this in mind. So I suppose what I took from that was, well, the real challenge is to connect myself with that deeper intelligence and let it lead me. And whether it includes what I've learned from Ron or whether it doesn't, I need to not be too concerned about that. So I, at some point, I realised that was going to be, it was okay either way. I let go of the attachment. And about 3 months after Ron had died, so I hadn't done anything with all this material, this friend of mine, some of you have heard me mention, a friend called Jamie Smart, who I hadn't seen for or heard of for about 5 years. And we'd only just known each other periodically here and there. And he just sent me an email out of the blue and said, I'm doing a workshop in a few weeks' time. You might be interested. If you want to come, come as my guest. Just like that. And I was like, okay, I have nothing else to do at the moment. I seem to be retired between jobs. And so I said, yeah, I'm interested. Tell me more. So he sent me a bit of stuff, and he said it's based on this stuff from someone you know you might have heard of called Sydney Banks. I hadn't. And it's called The Three Principles. And he said, as you know, I've spent the last 10 years building up my work as a NLP trainer. That was his thing, as a specialist in NLP. He'd become one of probably the top NLP trainers, certainly in the UK, if not worldwide. He had a massively successful business, not only training people, but also consulting and selling related products. He produced a lot of audio and video materials and stuff like that. So he had this really successful business, and he'd thrown it all in. He'd basically been exposed to this three principles stuff, and he just thought, I can't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's what got me interested. I thought, well, that's impressive. You know, that's the kind of deaf thing I would do, you know. So I was curious enough from that point of view to think, well, there must be something in it for him to give up, you know, everything he's worked for. He'd kind of given it up just like that. So I went along to this talk, this is a weekend talk that Jamie gave. And before I got there, I'd done a little bit of reading around it. The stuff I read didn't tell me anything, you know. Some of this might be familiar to some of you. I'd go on these websites and Sydney Banks and so on. I'd hear him talking. It's like, it sounds like a lovely man, but he's not telling me anything I don't know. You know, it had that just sort of blatantly obvious quality to it. He called it a little bit something different, these three principles. I hadn't heard that term before. But I'd heard mind, and I'd heard consciousness, and I knew about thought. But I hadn't seen it kind of put together that way. Now, from that first weekend with Jamie, and basically from the first morning of sitting in the room and listening to him, something in my body said yes. You know, I was just like, ah, that was it. And it was no big revelation. I can't say that I sat there and went, wow, you know, geez, I've just learned the thing that's going to change my life and change my work and everything. It was very, very subtle for me. It was almost nothing. It was just oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It was like that. Oh, yeah. It was just something I could gently nod and go, that's it. That's the bit that I hadn't clocked. That's the bit that I, even with Ron, he was so close to that, but there was still a piece missing that I hadn't seen.
Isn't it a bit like putting a glove on that fits so
yeah.
well that you kind of forget it?
You don't even
there.
Know that it's there because
yeah.
it fits so well. Exactly. It's a good way of putting it, because I slipped into it so comfortably I didn't even notice. And yet, suddenly, that was it. I realised I've just stepped into this world of three principle, and that, at least for the time being, that's my work now. It was as instantaneous as that. That's my work. And maybe I'll call it that, maybe I won't, but that's basically... Initially I had the idea that I'll be incorporating that. Which is kind of funny now, when I think about it. I thought, that's good, that's something I can incorporate. And because I'd done that with everything else. You know, I'd managed to incorporate the emotional release techniques, I'd managed to incorporate this, incorporate that. I thought, well, this is another thing I'm going to incorporate. What I hadn't seen at that point was that I had it the wrong way around. And you will know the reason for that. The reason is that what Sid Banks introduced or presented was, it was not a technique, it's not a tool, it's not a therapy to be incorporated. What he was actually addressing was the mechanism behind the scenes through which we humans experience and create our reality of life. And there was that, there's that phrase again, create your own reality. You know, a lot of resonances from the law of attraction days. So I thought, ooh, I've heard that, that's familiar, but this is different. Because he's not talking about, it's not talking about parking spaces, or even cars to put into parking spaces. He's talking about how you create your experience of whatever your circumstance is in life on the inside. I thought, ha, that's the missing piece. that's the bit that the law of attraction are not really talking about. They allude to it to some degree, but they don't emphasize it. They emphasize the stuff, you know. They emphasize the circumstance, or the whatever it is that you supposedly are able to bring into your life or to change in your life. This wasn't pointing in that direction. It was pointing in the other direction, saying, well, it doesn't matter about the stuff. You can have it or not have it. It's your experience of life that really counts. That's what we're really after, is an experience of life which is enjoyable and loving and fun and comfortable and creative. And I thought, well, yeah, I know that. That's what I learned in the emotional release work, is that everybody just wants to feel good. And what Sid Beck said was that the missing link is thought. I thought, well, really? I'm sure I've studied that along the way, and that can't have been it, you know? It's like, geez, I spent a long time thinking about stuff. I must have included thought in the equation somewhere. And he said, it's just thought. I said, well, how could I have missed that? And yet, I had really missed that. I'd missed the fact that there is this moment by moment by moment by moment something happening both in our brain and in our psyche that is making manifest whatever world we're experiencing in that moment. The only other place that I got close to this understanding was when I studied quantum physics. Not that I was a physicist, but I got curious about quantum physics years and years ago, because when I recognized that some of these physicists were using almost mystical language, or, you know, spiritual terminology. That was the only way they could describe what they were seeing, the subatomic level. And what they started to understand in the 1920s was that the so-called objective world does not exist. And it was very disturbing to their worldview at the time, you know, because for hundreds of years they'd known for a fact that it did. And then when they looked close enough, it didn't anymore. It's like, where the hell did it go? And they started to have crazy things happen. Like they found that if they set up an experiment looking for particle, they'd find particle. But if they set it up to measure waves, they'd find waves. And that wasn't supposed to be possible, you know. You're supposed to find what's there, not what you're looking for. And I really sympathise with I read some of the biographies of some of those physicists. Some of them had nervous breakdowns or similar, because it was like a shattering of their worldview. You can imagine, you know.
I know, because they've studied all their life believing something.
I know.
And that's the drastic change.
I really appreciated just what kind of an impact that must have had.
I can understand them breaking down.
Yeah, and one of them, I forget which one, it might have been Heisenberg or one of these guys, said if you're not completely disturbed and transformed, and you know, if your head is not completely messed up by this, you haven't understood it yet. I'm not saying it well, but that's basically what he said, is that anybody who understands what we've uncovered here, their world has turned upside down. Now, unfortunately, the physicists saw that 100 years ago, almost, and yet that understanding has barely seeped into the collective consciousness. It has to some degree in certain areas, but it hasn't really, to the extent that most of us still walk around in the superstition that there is this material world out there which is objective. And by objective, I mean it's the same for everybody. That's the worldview that pretty much everybody still holds. And it's really hard not to, isn't it? It's so compelling, you know. Well, of course, you know, this chair, it's the same for everyone, isn't it? You come and sit here, it's going to feel the same to you. There's so much evidence that suggests to our senses, at least, that there is this objective reality out there. Despite what the physicists are telling us, it's not true. It's illusory. So, using a completely different language, coming at it from a completely different perspective, Sid Banks was saying the same thing as what these physicists, so it was reminding me of that. I was like, wow, yeah, this is familiar to me. What he's saying is that reality out there doesn't exist in the same way for everybody. He's not saying it doesn't exist at all.
No, it's not the same.
He's saying it cannot be experienced in the same way by everybody, because it goes through a perceptual filter. So, and that perceptual filter is what we humans are gifted with. maybe not only humans, looks like some animals are gifted with, not the same, but with similar perceptual apparatus to the one that we have. So we have not only the senses, the five senses that are going around data gathering, you know, taking in this data from the environment, but we also have this perceptual mechanism which translates that data into something that we call reality. So it actually gets converted into not only imagery and sounds and so forth, but also feelings in our body. And this was to be where it got really interesting, because there was this emphasis on the fact that thought and feeling are connected. And I'd never heard that anywhere before. Anywhere.
It's brand new.
To me, that was the bit that I knew that there was something in this that was completely unique. So the other bits were all vaguely, you know, familiar from other places. They'd all been spoken about or touched on. But when I heard it said this way, that thought and feeling are one thing, that you are feeling, you're thinking, I was like, oh, really? Could that be true? And I wasn't sure for quite a while, I'll be honest with you. I wasn't sure about that. There's times when I still doubt it. But something in me recognised it. Something in me thought, geez, that's it. That's the bit that nobody in secret world, no one in law of attraction, no one in any of these emotional release, anywhere else, no one else has really clocked that. They've seen it to be true in a certain area, like I'd seen the connection between beliefs and feelings, but I thought beliefs were like this special case. You know, these are like super thoughts that have been thunk so often that they've got a lot of feeling attached to them. Yeah, but there's a lot of other thinking that doesn't. That's how I had it in my own mind. I'd created this special case for the beliefs. But Sid Banks was saying something completely different to that. He's saying, no, you're in the feeling of your thinking all the time. All the time. Whether you're awake, whether you're asleep, makes no difference. Now, when I started to get a sense that that might be true, it answered to me what was one of the biggest puzzles that I'd been racking my brains over for a few years, which was this. How is it that the human body does not know the difference between
what we imagine,
imaginary, and between what we imagine to be real and what's actually real? Mm-hmm. That had puzzled me for years. Mm-hmm. I thought it was really fascinating and really interesting that, for example, that we can have a dream. You know, a dream where we're in some situation where we're trapped in a house that's on fire or something like that. And if somebody put monitors on your body in that dream, your body's been flooded with adrenaline, your heart rate's going up, you start sweating, your blood pressure goes up, your physiology's responding as if it's actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had people watching monitors in another room and they didn't know that the person was asleep dreaming, they would say, this person's been traumatized right now. This person's in a stress response. They must be in a situation that's life-threatening.
And it's funny, isn't it? Because when you wake up from a dream, I often hear the children say, I just have to keep telling myself, it's just a dream.
Exactly.
It's just a dream.
Exactly.
You tell yourself that.
Mm.
So it's your...
To try and shake it off,
yeah.
You know,
and
shake off the feeling. Yeah. And as soon as you realise that, you're fully conscious again, what happens? It's all gone away. Your physiology settles down immediately. But
unless
when you were in it...
Yeah, it was real.
It was real.
Unless you start analysing it.
Well, yes. We won't go there. I've been there once too often.
Can I have a question about it?
Yeah.
So is there something you can do to control dreams? Because you just reminded me that my daughter has like horrible dreams now, and I don't know how to help her. So.
Well, I mean, yes, there are people that have found ways to work with dreams, obviously. There's two approaches that I know which... can be helpful. One is the Jungian approach,
mm-hmm.
where in the waking state you actually work with the person.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're working with is the content of the dream. And it is possible to bring the dream to life, if you like, while you're awake.
Mm-hmm.
And by so doing, you can have it, you can create a different ending,
mm-hmm.
obviously. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Or the psyche will itself create a different ending.
Mm-hmm.
The other way is the lucid dreaming, which people can learn to do. You know what lucid dreaming
no.
is? Where the person actually becomes conscious during
yeah.
the dream that they are dreaming.
That's what I told her. That's what
yeah.
I did. But
some people
no
can naturally do it, and some people can learn to do it, and some people, it seems, cannot. Or
mm-hmm.
find it very difficult to learn to do. But those are the techniques, right? Three principles is not a technique, so in that sense, no. It doesn't point you in the direction of that. But what I would say is that Hayana, Welcome. Come join us. What? Come and join us. What I would say is that, well, I know for a fact that people who've understood the nature of thought, which is what Three Principles teaches you, anybody who really starts to understand that, it has a healing effect on the psyche. And so that will be individual, how it plays out. But for some people, the healing effect is they stop having nightmares,
okay,
for example. It's been used very successfully in what we call post-traumatic stress, where one of the commonest symptoms is that people have terrible nightmares. You know, people who've been in war situations and so on. They have flashbacks when they're awake, and or they have these nightmares, which, you know, it's as if they're in the war situation again. And Three Principles for these people is transformative. It's been very, very, very helpful. So how old is your daughter now?
Eight.
She's eight, yeah. She's old enough to catch on to this easily. Easily. But the main thing is for you to have a good immersion in it,
yeah,
so that you have you deepen in your understanding, and then you'll find a creative way to transmit it to her. You may not even need to teach it to her, you know, in anything like the way that we're sharing it here. Just the fact that you start to get it, she'll start to pick up on it anyway. But there might also be opportunities where you can share it with her in child-friendly language. Because children are so close to knowing this.
Yeah, she does know it, actually, because she tells me she was, like, you know, swearing to me and stuff. And then in the evening we cuddle and she says, "Mom, I'm so sorry, but there's nothing I could do. It was the brain telling me to do it."
Yeah.
So I tell her, you know, you don't have to listen to your brain. You don't have to listen to it. She
says,
"I know, but that is, you know, I cannot control it now." So I said, "She got it. She described the three principles."
Exactly. She's onto it. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Children are so close to knowing it. They just don't know that they know it, you know. So the only bit that they need really is just a little conscious reminding of what they already know unconsciously. So, yeah, that was a piece of the puzzle that for me had plagued me for years. Was like, how come we're made that way? That didn't make sense to me. It seemed like an aberration, right? That we would be given this amazing, I mean, I've got this terrific respect for the human organism, not just the physical, but also the emotional and the psyche. It's been my thing all of my life. I've been privileged to work with people and to study, you know, what makes them tick, what they're interested in and what upsets us. And that's really what I've been passionate about my whole life. And this thing niggled at me. It's like, why would we be designed that way?
Mm-hmm.
That we can get just as traumatized by something that we just made up as we can by something that actually happened. That didn't make sense to me.
But the potential's amazing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, the potential is amazing. And I saw that too.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that understanding had been used in a positive way in sports psychology, for example, where they would have people run the race while sitting in an armchair. You know, rather than going and doing more training on the track, they would have people do mental training, just visualizing themselves pulling off a winning performance. And guess what? Their performance level went up.
Mm-hmm.
So it has that positive side for it as well. We can kind of fool the body into thinking that it's
mm-hmm.
actually doing something that it's not physically doing. But in the same way the body seemed to be fooled,
mm-hmm.
it seemed to be capable of being fooled, of thinking that it was in, say, a life-threatening situation when it wasn't. Now, that's when I made the connection between what Sid Banks was talking about, thought and feeling, and this question mark that I've been carrying around for ages. That's when I knew that Three Principles had Sid Banks himself called it the missing link. It had that feeling to it of like, it's just put some pieces together that for me, I couldn't see how they could ever be put together. Now, what would be your answer to that question now? Knowing what you know, how is it that the body can be so fooled and mistake the imaginary for the reality?
Because the reality is just a dream, it's the same thing.
Because we experience it in exactly
the same way.
It was so simple. It's just so simple. We don't experience reality directly. We experience it in an imaginary way.
Mm.
We make it up.
So imagination is everything. That is it.
Imagination.
Everything is imagined.
Exactly. That's what I suddenly saw. It's like, oh my God. It was so
you're
simple.
You're not really here.
Evidently, the whole world is made this way.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how the whole world is made. I really don't. I really don't. But I do know that I'm making up my experience of it.
I really noticed a few years ago, just observing this young woman who's a sort of gangster rapper and her world and the world that she lives in.
Yeah.
And, you know, this whole thing of, like, creating our world and... She just inhabits somewhere that I do not inhabit.
It's completely foreign to you.
Yeah,
it's
completely
like
foreign.
Going to another
and
country.
It really, because she was such a clear example, it really helped me
yeah.
sort of see kind of some of what you're saying.
Yeah, we think we have this shared reality
yes,
that we're all living
we
in.
Yes, we know. And she's that's what she's created. That's her world. That
yeah.
is how the world is.
Yeah.
You know, it's totally not my how I see it.
Yeah.
You know.
And what usually
yeah.
fools us is, because we tend to hang around with like-minded people.
Yes, exactly.
Right? So then it becomes more
because
likely.
Because you want it to be like that, so you're
yeah.
reinforcing it.
Yeah, it reinforces the idea
yeah.
that we do share the same
yeah,
world.
Yeah.
But it's only when you step into someone
yeah.
else's apartment or
yeah.
shoes or,
yeah.
Jesus, you know, what kind of world
yeah.
is this person living? So yeah, it's a good example. Every now and again we see that. We clearly don't live in the same world. The rest of the time we don't see it. It looks to us as if there is still this world out there that we're all living in. So that was something in me was just like, oh my God, how could I have missed that? How could I have missed that? That's so obvious. That's the reason. And what to me was such, it felt so good to me was like, there's not a mistake in the design. You know? I was so relieved about that for some daft reason. Because it always felt like this kind of aberration. I couldn't really fathom why that would be built into the human physiology. Why would it be that we'd be made that way so that we're capable of traumatizing ourselves by imaginary things? I could see that there was a sense in us having powerful feelings when we're in real life situations. You know, we talk about survival instincts and these kind of, yeah, that makes sense to me. But why would we have the capacity to set our physiology off into this kind of survival mode when nothing bad even happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? And suddenly I understood it. I said, well, even in the situation that's life-threatening, that's what we're doing. We just don't see it. We don't see it. What we do is we associate the feeling with something that's happening out there. And we think that that's what's causing the feeling. Huh. And it's an easy mistake to make. It's so compelling. And the funny thing is, really, it became laughable at a certain point. It's funny how we ignore the fact that we can have all the same feelings in a dream, despite the fact nothing's happened. You know? None of us really have a full appreciation of that, do we? Of just how wild that is. That we can have all the same feelings that we might conjure up in a real-life situation. And we were just in the comfort of our bed, having a dream. And as soon as we wake up, it's all gone away. We don't fully appreciate how profound that is. That we can be traumatized, we can have a love affair, we can see beautiful things, and we can hear music, and we can have all the whole gamut of emotional experience, and nothing happened. It all happened internally. We created this whole world and all the characters and everything in it, and the plot line. We wrote the script, we directed the thing, and we participated in it.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to experience everything that happened. And then we go, oh, it was just a dream. We dismiss it as it was just a dream.
Yeah.
And it changed something in me around that. I thought, well, wow, you know, I'd appreciated the fact that Jung was so keen on that dreams are important, you know. Dreams are intelligent. There's a wisdom behind this. But even he missed the boat, unfortunately. The reason I say that is that he got distracted by the content. And that was the other thing that was such a relief to me was that for the first time, with all the things that I'd learned and studied and got interested in, here was something that said, quite explicitly, don't worry about the content. You don't have to worry about changing the thoughts, changing the beliefs, changing the dreams, even changing the feelings. None of that needs to be your business, needs to be your concern. That there is something behind the scenes that's making all of that happen. And if you understand how that works, if you get a feel for how that works, the content will take care of itself in a harmonious and benevolent way. I was like, really? Really? Is that possible? I really don't have to get into that. I don't even have to figure out what the belief is, let alone try and change it without getting throttled in the process. You know? I was like, huh. And yet I knew that that must be so. I just, something in me was like, yeah, that makes sense. I had the image at some point of a bubble machine. Came to me. You know when you have a cartoon of someone having a thought? It's always a bubble, isn't it? It's like this bubble or a series of bubbles. And suddenly I had this image of a bubble machine. And, you know, as a bubble goes off, and it's a thought, and we latch onto that thought, we bring it to life with consciousness, and then we have all the feelings that go with it. We're in that bubble right now. And sometimes we had a whole bunch of other bubbles to it, so it starts to seem like, you know, this is how my life is right now. And then a few days or weeks or months later, our life has changed. We forget. You know, we forget how bad it was, or we forget how good it was, because we're into the next series of bubbles. But what I saw was that it doesn't matter how many bubbles you work with, and it doesn't matter how good you are at popping them or getting rid of the ones you don't like and changing the shape and size of them, the bubble machine is always on.
Mm-hmm. So all we have to do is just find it and destroy it, and that's it.
Well, I think that's been tried in psychiatry, actually. They call it a frontal lobotomy. Or
that's what I actually said. Year before the training, but that's all it's going to do it for me, you know.
I mean, it can seem like that's the only answer to candidate at the time. You know, if you've got a busy mind, it would seem like the main relief would be if someone can just cut it off at source for a moment. That would be great. And of course, meditation practice, that's what that's geared towards. Mm. Really, most meditation is aimed towards somehow quietening that noise of the just the activity, the thought activity, which is so relentless. They've obviously recognized, you know, the Buddhists and the Zen people, these guys have recognized over millennia that it's that drives us crazy. It's not anything out there. What makes us crazy is that mental activity that we seemingly cannot control. We can't switch it off, we can't control it. What do they do is they try and develop techniques to do just that. Well, maybe at least we can slow it down, you know. So they have you concentrating on the gap between the thought. Let's try and make that a bit bigger, you know. Mind the gap. I know people have been trying to mind the gap for decades. And you know what? They're still making themselves crazy with their thinking. Because the bubble machine's always on. So when I saw that, I thought, well, I don't know whether that's true and possible. That just somehow grasping or getting a sense for where it's coming from, like the nature of how it's been created. Somehow what he seemed to be saying, Sid Banks, was that if you understand the nature of that, then the content takes care of itself. The content somehow becomes something that, even though it's still happening, it won't bother you so much. You'll have the ability to be less bothered by it. And then, paradoxically, it will also start quietening down, even without you trying. And some of you might have experienced that. Anyone experienced that? To some degree, at least some of the time? Yeah. Not all the time, necessarily. But that often creeps in as a side effect of getting an awareness of what this is about. People will sometimes report, geez, my mind was just blank for a while. It was really... And sometimes they're a bit shocked by that because they're not used to it. You know, there's just this kind of space opens up where there's usually a lot of chatter. And it's like, whoa, that's strange. Some people are quite struck by the newness of that, but they haven't experienced that before. So it seemed to be that this was something worth exploring. And yeah, within a few months, really, it was just the beginning of the year, I remember, that I'd got interested in this through Jamie. after that, I was like, okay, give me what you've got. And you send me all your stuff. Give me what can I read? What can I watch? There wasn't much, actually. It was very limited material to go at. But I went at it anyway, a little bit. And then I found, well, what I remembered was, actually, what I do is I learn by teaching. I'd forgotten that momentarily. I've always learned by sharing with other people. So I thought, well, I know 0.1%. So if I share my 0.1% with people who've got 0.0%, I might just get away with it. And in the process, we'll together, they'll help me to go a little bit deeper. And that was this course that we started last year. We started the year before, didn't we, with you guys?
I'm glad that you did.
Huh?
I'm very glad that you did.
Well, me too. And I was pleasantly surprised that anybody showed up. Because the hardest thing is like, well, what the hell do you put on the flyer, you know? What do you tell people that they're going to learn? And, I mean, to all of your credit, you weren't too bothered that I put all this vague, waffly nonsense that didn't really tell you anything. No, it was.
We all created our own reality.
You all
was,
somehow you projected your own fantasies onto that, which was great. Either that, or you just thought, well, it's Ian, and you know we know him well enough that there must be something in it, even if it's not what he thinks. So
you do have a lovely gift, though, to be able to explain things in a way that resonates.
Mm. Well, thank you. Yeah, and that's my joy and my work is to share what little bit I've managed to piece together. But in so doing, it helps me to learn it deeper. So I just thought, well, okay, let's create a vehicle for that, and off we went.
And it's so difficult to communicate the three principles that with the friends and with my like-minded friends.
I know.
Honestly, it's so difficult.
Yeah.
So I admire it. I really am listening carefully, thinking, how can I myself, but you can communicate only in your own personal way.
That's it.
That's the only thing.
That's the starting point,
yeah,
is to
recognize
that.
The starting point, you must come to your own place where you are comfortable and use what you can.
Yeah.
What I find is that I'm starting to see the bigger picture. Not more the. I can see the wood for the trees. Is that the word?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that poses a problem as well, because I can see things now clearly that other people can't see.
That's right.
And then I have the dilemma of seeing something I can see very clearly that they can't see clearly.
Mm-hmm. What's the dilemma?
That I see something that this person's going headlong into.
Yeah.
That it could affect me and my daughter, my family, but I just can't get them to see it.
Right.
With Eva. I only know from it, it's an insight that I know that this isn't somehow. It's trying to, like Yitka says, trying to get that conveyance to them.
I know.
But maybe they don't want to.
No, they don't.
It's not like this is a private club, you know, it's available to absolutely everybody.
No. That's true.
That's right.
That's true. But I think wanting to is also a relative term, you know, it's a fluid thing because.
We don't want to, we can't. We're
that's I think
unable
that's
to.
Yeah, that's more closer to it because if you know, if you were able to say to someone, if you were able to sit somebody down and say, okay, so here's your life as it is, you've got this and this and this and this, and these are the things that you'd like and so on, but given your life experience as it is now, here's your job, here's your family, here's your kids, here's your relationship or not, which would you prefer? Would you like to have all of that and wake up and feel good and have relatively easy relationship with your loved ones and enjoy your work and be free of stress and anxiety and have all those things in your life but without those negative stressful feelings bothering you very much? Or would you like to have the same things and get really stressed out every day and get really tormented and be frustrated and anxious and worried? Which would you prefer? Now, if you put it like that, to pretty much anybody, it's a no-brainer, isn't it? If you put it in that kind of terminology, you said to someone, if I could show you a way that you could have the life that you want and a lot more besides, or the life that you have already and a lot more besides, but your experience of it could be so much easier, so much more enjoyable, so free of a lot of the things that have been bothering you now, what, a lot of problems that seem to be showing up. Would you go for that? Would you be interested in that? And by the way, it's free. It's not going to cost you anything. And you're not going to have to wear ropes or, you know. You don't have to sit facing a wall for 5 hours a day, chanting nonsense, anything like that. You don't even have to read any books, anything. Now that's the point where it becomes a harder sell, because when you say to someone, give them the choice, which would you prefer? Everybody will say, yeah, that. Now it's okay. So tell me what to do, right? Well, what do I need to do? Where's the manual? Where's the technique? And that's when we go, okay. Now let me find a creative way to put this across to you. That's when the fun starts, isn't it? And just like in homeopathy, what do homeopaths say? Who are the hardest people to prescribe for? The ones that you live with, the ones that you're up against every day, the ones that seem to have the ability to drive you nuts for various reasons. Well, it's exactly the same with three principles. These are also the ones where it's often the most challenging ones to help understand what you've seen. Not because they're a special case, not because they're different to other human beings. The only difference is you've got more thought on them. And you've got more investment in them getting it.
Yes.
Which is what? Thought. That's all investment is. It's more thought. So you've got more thought in the way. And the more thought we have in the way, the harder our job gets.
Mm-hmm.
And we think it has to do with them. Why are they so stupid? Why are they so stubborn? Why do they not want to hear it and everybody else does? It's nothing to do with them. It's to do with the fact that we get overly invested, overly attached. And we've got our own ideas of why we think it would be good for them to know.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you've got any idea why you think it would be good for someone else to know, you're in no position to teach.
Absolutely.
So this again is the... And I've always known that. You know, you guys have probably always known it. Any of you have practiced in a one-to-one setting, you'll have learnt this. You try and push a client to get well who hasn't seen for themselves that they could or that it's possible for them. It just engenders resistance, you know. It's not helpful, it's the opposite of helpful. So you have to learn to back off and to yield and to be gentle and to earn the permission. You have to earn the permission, and you have to find a way to make rapport, establish rapport first of all, so that there's somehow a common connection. And then when there's enough trust and there's an opening, the person really hears that you're not trying to change them, you're not trying to turn them into your version of what you think they should be. When they really hear that, then there's an opening. There's a receptivity. Now you're in a position to share what you've understood. So this is a challenge that we have. Sue, I want to call you Sue.
Carol.
I knew it wasn't right. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Where's Sue?
Sue's next.
Yes. I always did this with you guys. Sorry, I'm still doing it. Carol, this is our challenge with the nearest and dearest.
Mm-hmm.
We have to somehow sit in the awareness that we have, knowing how valuable it is and how wonderful it is, and at the same time being open to share it with anyone who's got the ears to hear it without any attachment to the idea that they should be ready, you know, or that it would benefit
mm-hmm.
them if. Letting all that go and then looking for an opening. And the openings do present sometimes. And sometimes they don't. That's just it. Sometimes we have to stumble through life and get and experience the hurt that brings often enough that that's what wakes us up. You know? And we can't necessarily prevent that. You know, we can't insulate people from the amount of suffering that they need, which is just the right dose, that's going to get them to the point where they go, you know what, enough, okay. What is it you've been banging on about? I'm ready to hear it now. And at some point they will be. Maybe not from you, but from somebody.
We can't decide for anyone else.
We can't.
This sort of work.
As much as we would like to.
Just to let go.
Could we have a little break, do you think?
Yeah.
After my rambling introduction. I don't know why I started with that today, but I felt like I wanted to. So we'll have a little.
Good start.
Good start, thank you.
The kettle has boiled in the kitchen area out there.
Okay.
And I assume there are coffee shops to be found.
There's a coffee shop on the other side of the road about
doing rail
50
coffee.
Yards up.
Well, there's a greasy spoon.
Which is kind of a greasy
okay.
spoon, doesn't look too bad.
Okay.
There's
if anybody wants to venture out.
There's a cafe right on the corner.
They do Ely coffee, which is really nice.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm.
What, just
how long have we got?
Just on the corner.
How long have we got?
20 minutes
on
or something.
The way, on the corner
long enough to go to the cafe and back if you want to get decent coffee. Is anybody going that way? Do you mind getting me a cappuccino, small cappuccino, please? I'll give you some dosh.
That's
all right.
How are you?
You are too.
You've got
shiny stars.
Very.
Yes,
I
think I'm in a good place.
Hi. Welcome.
Thank you.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, I'm doing this as well.